the reason Powell is raising rates is because he's trying to fight inflation. Mm-hmm. And the more he raises rates, the more economic turmoil that seems to be causing. Right. Namely, and we're going to get to this in a little bit, in the realm of bank failures. Okay, so that's starting to happen. Another bank failed this week, which we'll talk about in a minute. Bankless Nation, it is the first Friday of May. It's Friday morning. Hope you brought your coffee. David, what time is it?
Ryan, it's the Bankless Friday weekly roll-up where we cover the entire weekly news in crypto, which is always an ambitious endeavor, yet we persevere nonetheless into the frontier. How are you doing this week,
David? I'm doing well. I don't know if the banks can say the same, though, because we got more bank failures on the menu.
Season two.
That's
of
a
bank
big
failures.
Topic. Big topic of conversation. We're also going to talk about Jerome Powell and the Fed raising interest rates. How high can they go? That's the question we got to ask. David, what else are we covering today?
Balaji waves the right white flag on his bet a little bit early. He capitulates, says Bitcoin's not going to go to $1 million in the next 6 weeks.
June 17th
was when it was over. Okay, well, it is May 4th. So he's waving the white flag, donated $1.5 million. And so we're going to cover that. And then also, there are some other mainnets just dropped. So Eigenlayer mainnet, the Sui mainnet, the Axelar has an announcement, and Lens has a layer 3 that we talked about last week. We got some stats. And then speaking of mainnets, not really mainnet, but Coinbase International, new exchange just got announced. So bunch of stuff to run through in this Friday weekly roll-up.
Yeah, totally. Always jam-packed for you guys. Of course, if you like this episode, if you like what we're doing over here at Bankless, make sure you like and subscribe. That's how we pop up on the charts on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, on YouTube. You know how to do it.
Just really
like,
important.
Subscribe. It's
important
very important. Yeah, especially in the bear market. All right. Yeah. Can you spare a like, guys?
Please spare a like.
One thing before we get into the markets today, David, we got to talk about our friends and sponsors over at Swell. Swell is a staking protocol, and this is a staking season. I'm calling it not just spring, but it's also staking season. David, tell them about Swell.
Swell is a brand new staking as a service protocol entering the foray of the LSD world. But since they are brand new, they are charging 0% staking fees. So they are the highest yielding staking provider out on the market. Brand new simple interface. And one of the new competitive advantages about Swell is that you can also get DeFi yield along with your ETH yield. So some interesting new innovations to be competitive in this market. And they are also looking to frontier technologies to improve the product. Something that's getting me excited, like DVT, is something that is on the Swell roadmap.
They decentralized have staking.
Yes. Squad staking. Exactly. They have this thing called a Voyage, which they are teasing. I don't know what's in the Voyage, but it is starting soon, and they would like you to know about it. So there is a link in the show notes to go explore.
It is staking season, David. Look at that APR, 4.5% on your ETH. And I don't know about you, David, but risk-free sounds pretty good right now with all the bank failures going around. I'd rather have my ETH in a staking protocol than in a bank account, that's for sure.
Protocol or bank? Protocol or bank? What you want? What you want?
Speaking of that, let's get to the markets today, all right? Mm-hmm. How are we looking on a Bitcoin on the week? Are we up? We down? We sideways?
We are sideways. Sideways week. Literally nothing to report. $28,000 and $900.
You're telling me we could have just skipped this entire week? Yeah. It didn't even matter?
Yeah. That's about right. Yeah. Not even 1% move on either Bitcoin or Ether.
The same, both just flat, flat.
$1,888. The most interesting thing about Ether right now is that there are 3/8 in the price.
Man, we could have just saved the last roll-up recording clip and just replayed it, huh? Same price. Uh-huh. Nothing changed.
I mean, we got some volatility. We went down to 800. Oh, we almost got back above 2,000, but
ETH Bitcoin ratio also flat?
It's also unchanged.
This is weirdly flat.
Yeah. But also, Bankless Nation, I'll remind you, please pull up your tracker apps, your price trackers, and make sure that the prices have not moved in the last 24 hours.
And if you want some of the best charts in the biz, you got to go check out Kraken Pro over here, pro.kraken.com. Professional interface. So all of my charts look very professional these days, David. It wasn't like that before. And I'm learning how to chart a little slowly.
Yeah, you are. Slowly but surely.
It's taking some time. Slowly but surely. Well, let's talk about the big news today, David, which is the Fed raising rates, the big news this week at least. So the Fed just raised rates, interest rates, by 0.25% percent, or as you like to call it, 25 basis points.
I love calling it that.
I know you always are speaking always in terms of basis points. So here's the press release. If you want to read something, you know, kind of boring, and what the notes are about this, but 5.25%, between 5 and 5.25% range. That's a 16-year all-time high. Hmm. We haven't been higher in interest rate in 16 years. It was 16 years ago. When was that, David? It was before 2008, before the, you know, financial crash. Yeah, we're talking like mid-2000s. What were you doing in the mid-2000s? Last time the rates were this high.
Middle
were you buying
school?
A house?
No. I was not under strain.
Did you know that rates existed?
Not at all. No, I just understood that my parents were stressed. Oh wait, no. This was pre housing crisis. Never mind. Yeah.
No, everything was fine. It was about to get things were about,
it was about
to get bad.
To get, yeah, right.
Huh.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, sense that high interest rates created the housing bubble to pop. That makes sense.
Do you think kids in middle school right now are talking about inflation or interest rates at all? Or are they just
way
kids
more
in middle
than
school?
I was when I was in middle school.
The kids are getting smarter every generation. That's what's happening, I think. But you know what? This is kind of the decision point here, right? Because Jerome Powell has a question. The reason Powell is raising rates is because he's trying to fight inflation. Mm-hmm. And the more he raises rates, the more economic turmoil that seems to be causing.
Right.
Namely, and we're going to get to this in a little bit, in the realm of bank failures. Okay, so that's starting to happen. Another bank failed this week, which we'll talk about in a minute. And I kind of feel like Powell is choosing maybe the worst of both worlds. Like, so we're going to end up with high inflation anyway, and also bank failures. That's my critique as to what's going on. On the other hand, like, I don't know, maybe the guy's actually not in control of anything. It just seems like, what happens, David, if we tighten so much that we cause a cascade of 2008-like economic effects, right? We just had our third major bank failure this week, and we're still raising rates. It seems like a bad time to be raising rates, but I'm not a central banker.
I want to present the counter argument to that point.
Go for it.
So we got to raise rates because inflation's still up, right? Core inflation has not gone down. The more volatile, more expressive inflation has come down, but core inflation, things like services and goods, have gone up, right? That's the hard part. So that's why we got to keep on raising interest rates. And then when the bank failures occur, that's a sign of raising interest rates. Of course, economics and finance are just harder. And I think that what the Fed is able to do with bailing out these individual banks as they fail is like the Fed is raising the interest
more
rates,
surgical.
And then they are catching the distressed banks on the way down. So it's not a like an impact. They're just cradling the bank failure into the ground.
and then they're catching
the next one. And so
they are
actually able to continue to increase rates because they are surgically catching the catastrophes that they are causing, which allows them to continue to raise rates because they're not, they're like, oh, there's contagion, gotta go catch it. And it's working so far.
Maybe, but also has a whole bunch of unintended consequences as well that we'll get to and I worry about.
Oh, like,
one of which is
like bank consolidation into too big to fail banks so that the banking sector becomes nationalized. Doesn't sound like it's unintended.
That's kind of what's happening, right?
Yeah.
But I do think the picture you just painted is what the central bankers in Powell would like to have happen, right?
Right.
I just worry. I think we're going to get, there's a very real possibility, David, at this point, we get the worst of both worlds in that we're not able to cradle the banks on their way down, but we just get cascading bank failures and also
massive high inflation,
right? So just like, what was the point? I don't know. That's the risk that we're running.
Inflation, but economic deflation. Oh, that sounds awful.
We'll have to see what happens. That is what stagflation is.
That is what stagflation is.
From the policy statement this week, anyway, the language saying that the Fed, this has been previous Fed language, that it anticipates further rate increases would be needed. That wasn't in here.
Right.
So this does seem like this is the top rate rise.
Right.
And it was only 25 basis points, as you like to say. So I guess not that big.
We were hoping for the pivot. The pivot some of people were, we are no yes. longer increasing interest rates and now we're just going to hold it is not exactly the pivot that we were looking for as an industry that has very high risk crypto assets on this curve.
I mean,
we were
ultimately
hoping for a reversal.
Look, ultimately though, David, I want crypto to deserve it. I want our like industry to deserve it and not just be kind of a money printer hedge completely. Like I want us to provide a pure utility. I want the U.S. economy to be in an okay shape. And I don't want things to kind of cascade downward and, you know, just the casino markets to rain. So I'm not sure what the best position is here. But Jim Bianco here has a different take. His take is the Fed knew the risks already of bank failures. Powell knew the risks and he's being a careless being here. He's being reckless here. He puts this in a tweet thread. On February 14th, the Fed board was given a presentation that went through the risks to the banking system due to unrealized losses because of the rapidly rising interest rates. It gave this example of a bank sitting on unrealized losses and particularly vulnerable. This was February 14th, mind you, before the bank failures. After hearing this presentation, Powell went ahead with very hawkish testimony. That was on March 7th and 8th. The probability of a 50 basis point hike on March 22 soared based on Powell's words. And less than 48 hours later, Silicon Valley Bank failed and the Fed backed off to a 25 basis point hike. The point Bianco's making here is that Powell's getting into reckless territory, right? Mm. He's making these policy decisions and then he's seeing bank failures and he's adjusting them a little, but he's still edging towards kind of the brink of cascading bank failures. I think Bianco's criticism is he knows this is a risky game. Why are we playing this game with the US banking system right now? So that is the critique of Powell's actions.
I guess the illustration that I gave is that, bank failure, Fed steps in and like cradles it on the way down, really depends on that they fail in a very orderly manner. And I don't think that
gracefully
that's how
fail.
That works. I think orderly and contagion banking crisis are not things that I would put into the same sentence.
It's a little bit like the bike wobbling downhill, you know, when you start to oscillate and it's like, okay, now we're oscillating right here. And then it gets to a point where it's catastrophic, unrecoverable, and the bike tips over if it's going too fast. And that is the worry here.
If it's going too slow. And if it's going too slow, it's because interest rates are adding friction to economic transactions. And so in order to correct for wobbles, we need it to go faster, which means we got to lower the interest rates, baby. We got to take them down. Let's get that Fed pivot going.
Well, David, I think that's what we have to talk about next. First Republic bank failure, the biggest since 2008. That's coming up next. What else we got?
Coinbase International launches in Bermuda. So one trad bank down, but one crypto bank up. Eigenlayer mainnet is incoming as well. The Sui mainnet as well. Bankless listener, put a number in your mind as to what you think the market cap of Sui is, because that number will come later in the show as soon as we talk to these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible, especially Kraken, our preferred crypto exchange for 2023, the one that we all know and love while we watch the charts earlier in this episode. If you do not have an account with Kraken, consider signing up using that link in the show notes. Let's go hear from Kraken right now.
Kraken Pro has easily become the best crypto trading platform in the industry. The place I use to check the charts and the crypto prices, even when I'm not looking to place a trade. On Kraken Pro, you'll have access to advanced charting tools, real-time market data, and lightning-fast trade execution, all inside their spiffy new modular interface. Kraken's new customizable modular layout lets you tailor your trading experience to suit your needs. Pick and choose your favorite modules and place them anywhere you want in your screen. With Kraken Pro, you have that power. Whether you are a seasoned pro or just starting out, join thousands of traders who trust Kraken Pro for their crypto trading needs. Visit pro.kraken.com to get started today. Bankless is launching the Bankless Token Hub. At Bankless, we've been studying the crypto markets ever since 2017, and all of our research has led us to this, the Token Hub. You're a one-stop shop for alpha to help you navigate through the crypto markets. Have you ever wished for a trusted resource that would share their thoughts, ratings, and their opinions about tokens? Boy, do we have the product for you. The Bankless Token Hub is where we provide Bankless citizens with the alpha on the hottest tokens in crypto. We do the research so you don't have to. The Bankless Token Hub includes the token ratings, where our team shares their research and outlook on the hottest tokens in crypto. Also, the Token Hub includes Bankless Bags, our own internal investment club. Bankless Bags Tags is where we put our money where our mouth is. And for the Bankless Power user out there, you can access the analyst team 24/7 inside the Bankless Nation Discord. You can ask them questions and learn from a group of people deep in the weeds of crypto investing. The last feature of the Token Hub is the ability to upvote or downvote token ratings. The Bankless Token Hub lets you learn from your fellow citizens to rate these tokens yourselves. The Bankless Token Hub is launching right now and has already been beta tested by your fellow Bankless citizens. So stay tuned in the Bankless Discord for updates. And if you're not a Bankless citizen, well, you better sign up if you want access, because this corner of Bankless is available for citizens only. I'll see you in the Discord.
David, we have Bank Failure Season 2. The second biggest bank failure ever in U.S. history just happened this week. And I feel like people are barely talking about it. Yeah. They're kind of talking about it. This is a First Republic Bank based in San Francisco, California. Pretty big. $200 billion plus in assets. So this was a big one. David, what happened?
Well, I think I'll throw the question to you, Ryan. What happened that was different than any of the other banks? So banks bought a lot of long-term dated securities, and then the Fed jacked up the interest rates, and then this bank failed just like the other ones. This one was different in that it got a $30 billion injection from JP Morgan and a number of other too-big-to-fail banks. And then that depleted, that it also ran out because customers chose to withdraw. And then eventually the FDIC said, like, man, this bank's not going to make it. We're going to throw the white flag on behalf of First Republic.
That's basically what happened.
My interpretation of events.
So regulators took possession of First Republic on Monday. Mm-hmm. This is the biggest bank failure since 2008, the second biggest in U.S. history, when there was a bank called Washington Mutual that exploded in the 2008 crisis.
That was my first bank ever as a child. That was my first checking account. Yep.
Your first was Washington Mutual? Is that based in like the Seattle area?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Washington State?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so it no longer exists. I'm not sure what happened to them. I'm sure they became part of a bigger bank here.
What did you do with that account?
It's still there. You still got it, Dan. I think this has a lot of similarities with the first bank failures that we saw, including Silicon Valley Bank. The difference here is, you know how Silicon Valley Bank, their big kind of debt was in startups, Silicon Valley startups. Well, for First Republic, they were in the jumbo mortgage business. So,
not
big
crypto?
Mansions, not crypto, big
That's
houses.
That's not what Gary Gensler said.
It's another asset. Well, he'll probably blame this one on crypto too, David. Don't you worry. Sure. Give him some time. All right. Have faith in Gensler. Jumbo mortgages were their shtick. Okay. And so when rates were low, of course, they gave out a ton of these loans, as one does. And then the Fed raised rates. The value of the mortgages, the collateral went down, of course. But then also, the treasuries on the balance sheet also went down in value too, under par value, thus making the bank insolvent. So for me, it reminds me a lot of Silicon Valley Bank. So all the lessons that we learned a couple of weeks ago have come into play here, except the asset class wasn't Silicon Valley tech companies. It was jumbo mortgages.
Well, it also wasn't United States treasuries. And so I think this is probably like where the fear kind of strikes. Two reasons. One, we have another a single bank failure isn't a crisis, but like, all of the other banks that failed happened those numbers of weeks ago in that like pocket of time.
It's all related.
Now we have this bank failing for the same reasons, different asset class. So mortgages, treasuries.
They did have some treasuries on the balance sheet, so that didn't help. But yes, go on.
I think the point is, this is like the balance sheet. Doesn't matter what the balance sheet is. Doesn't matter what the asset class is. The issue was that the Fed raised interest rates too fast. So it doesn't matter, like, was it United States Treasuries or just like long-dated securities or whatnot. Yeah. Like, all banks are getting distressed by the whiplash of the rising interest rates.
Particularly.
And also the timing, like, how long ago were the other banking crises? Like, 6 weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
And so 6 weeks later, we have another big banking crisis. I would have felt better. It would have been easier to be comfy if all of the banks collapsed in the same time frame.
But now
now we have one that's 6 weeks later. And so the question is to me that I have is like, okay, clearly the common denominator is not the asset class. This is not this contagion is not contained to a specific.
No, it's not just crypto. It's not just Silicon Valley tech companies for sure. This is something different.
This is, and that's the big common denominator is the whiplash behind the rising interest rates, which affects all banks. And now, 6 weeks later from the crisis, we have another bank that fails, which begs the question, how do you know when it's over? And are there more shoes to drop? Are there more banks to fail?
So this
and are
is
we at the beginning of this thing?
Another pattern here for you is another mid-sized bank, basically. It's not one of the too big to fail banks here, right? It's another Silicon Valley bank-sized bank that just went belly up. And so in the common denominator, as you said, is rising interest rates. So here's what happened. The bank failed effectively. The FDIC stepped in. That happened on Monday. And then what they do is they auction off all of the assets. So all the people's savings account in First Republic, somebody's got to bank them still, right? The FDIC is not going to just say, sorry, your money's gone, right? Of course, shareholders get wiped out in these sorts of situations. So that means a bigger bank has to go buy the assets, buy First Republic, so it can still stay functional and operational. That bigger bank happened to be our friends over at JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon and company. There was an auction. JP Morgan won the auction against two other bidders. Those other bidders were also very large banks. And so JP Morgan ended up with the $92 billion in deposits, which includes $30 billion that it and the other large banks put into First Republic to try to prop them up previously, as you mentioned, and $137 billion in loans and $30 billion in securities. Okay, so that's what they took over. So the bigger bank just got even bigger. And then the FDIC absorbed the losses on the mortgages and the commercial loans. And it also provided a $50 billion credit line. So it's going to cost the FDIC Deposit Insurance Fund about $13 billion. SVB cost $20 billion for comparison. These losses, David, what happens to them? Oh, the FDIC just takes care of them. They were socialized. We, taxpayers, it cost us. And so these risky investments and the interest rate rise is ultimately costing taxpayers. So that is the cost. We were talking about like earlier of, Jerome Powell is hopefully like cradling these banks down as they die. Well, there is a cost to this. And the cost is JP Morgan gets bigger. JP Morgan, David, now has 10% of all American deposits. All right. Under federal regulation, it actually can't rise anymore. They made an exception for JP Morgan to actually make this acquisition. So the banks just get even bigger. The too big to fail banks get bigger. And then also these losses are socialized, right? It's like the average taxpayer wasn't responsible for that loan for a jumbo mortgage. I mean, this is reminiscent of 2008 all over again. And you also can't say,
Before you move on. So I heard a slightly different story. So I want to throw in what I think could be a correction here. Taxpayers are not, it's not going to the taxpayers. It's going to, because of the FDIC Deposit Insurance Fund, that comes from banks. Banks pay for that. So that comes from bank money to fill up the deposit insurance fund. So that's coming out of that. But where does the banks get the money to pay for the insurance fund? Like fees on customers and in the economy. And so while taxpayers aren't being charged directly, it ultimately goes back to the consumer because banks are going to have to charge higher rates for all their products and services down the line. That was the take that I heard. And then the other thing that the take that I heard is like, you said that they made an exception so that JP Morgan could buy this bank. That was not an exception made right now. That was an exception already made in Dodd-Frank forever ago, where big banks that are so large above a certain threshold can't get bigger by buying banks unless that bank is failing. And so this was an exception built into Dodd-Frank forever ago. These are my interpretations of what I've heard.
Yeah, I think you're right, David. Those are definitely worthwhile details to clarify. So the banks got bigger. The losses were socialized in the form of higher, bank fees, taxpayers ultimately get paid by the people. I also think that it's becoming less defensive. I haven't heard anyone in Congress, anyone in the US government blame a particular party for this one, right? Mm-hmm. Very easy to blame kind of the crypto bros first, and then more widely kind of the tech bros, Silicon Valley people for the second. But when you have this pattern of mid-sized banks failing, right? And like, who are you going to blame now? This is starting to look systemic, guys. It's starting to look like a problem. And I want to pull up this chart. I think this was the graphic of the week. Did you see this, David?
Yeah.
Whew. Describe what we're looking at. This is a timeline. I'll start by describing. This is a timeline from 2002 all the way to 2023. Mm-hmm. And we see on this timeline a series of circles, series of what look like dots. And the size of the circle represents the number of assets in the bank that failed. So for every bank failure, there's a circle. And the really big banks get bigger circles. And so, David, describe what we see in bank failures around the 2008 to 2012 time range. What are we looking at?
Yeah, so we talked about how the First Republic Bank is the second largest bank failure in U.S. history. Well, the first largest is the big blue, the big circle that is in the 2008 housing crisis, Washington Mutual Bank, $307 billion. And then you see, like, how would you describe it? Just like dots and
stacked snowballs all the way up, like a
so mountain. Like big circle, and then a mountain of tiny little snowballs that you actually can't.
Only, there's like mountain.
There's like 300 dots in there of various sizes, but they're all small, and only three of these dots I can actually actually have the names of the banks in them. So IndyMac Bank, Colonial Bank, Guarantee Bank. All the other ones are just dots, because they're too small to actually fit the names of the banks into. So that's
these are all bank failures. All bank failures. So what happened to these dots? What happened to these dots, David?
Om nom 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 nom. Is that a technical term?
Yeah.
They got gobbled up by the bigger banks. Yeah. Right? And so fast forward to where we are today, 2003. There are only three big dots. First Republic Bank at $229 billion. Silicon Valley Bank at $209 billion. And Signature Bank at $110 billion. Which goes back to my question. This is just season two of the bank crisis TV show. How many seasons are there? Is the right side of this timeline, which we are about to go into in the 2023-2024, going to be similar to what we see on the left, but with bigger dots?
Right. And look how big these dots are already.
Because there's more money now. There's a lot more money out there in banks and... Right, like, is there are like 300 dots in 2008. We got three dots.
picture, if you, we're trying to describe this, the best way is just to go to YouTube and get the visual, okay, podcast listeners. So sometimes you just got to capitulate and look at the video here to get the graphic. But what we're looking at is a mountain of snowballs in 2008 versus a snowman in 2023.
Right.
Right? We just got big circles and it. Slightly smaller circle and then kind of a head circle. That's what we're looking at. And this represents, David, what looks like the second, third, and fourth largest bank failure in U.S. history.
And
it all
succession.
Happened this year.
Yeah.
It's pretty big. Like, this doesn't look good. This doesn't look healthy. And to your question is, what happens next? David, do you want to hear Arthur Hayes' take?
Hit me with it.
All right. So here's Arthur Hayes. Of all of the season one banking crisis conversations we had, the Arthur Hayes conversation sticks out the most in my mind, and I think is maybe the most predictive of what we're seeing start to happen. And if you recall, David, from that conversation, in fact, you were on it, I wasn't, I just listened to it a couple times after that episode. He basically predicted, okay, I will remind you, I will pod-splain it to you, David. It's like... He said that the midsize and small banks were in real trouble in the U.S., that they're basically insolvent, but slow motion type insolvent. So he wasn't predicting that Bitcoin would go to a million in 90 days and, you know, massive bank crisis. He said like it could take a year or two and the Fed would have to basically step in and do something absolutely massive that would result in a whole bunch of money printing, trillions and trillions of dollars worth of money printing. So here's his take. After the FRC, the First Republic collapse, a longer essay coming soon on my take. This JP Morgan First Republic deal means the US regulators decided to nationalize the banking system. Nationalize the banking system. He goes on, the eight too big to fail banks are effectively nationalized because they have government guarantee on their entire deposit base. They will not be allowed to fail regardless of decisions they make. Socialized losses, privatized gains, it's a great deal. But when called upon, the eight too big to fail banks must absorb their shitty cousins who couldn't handle the rough and tumble free market. The prodigal children's equity holders will get a zero first, but the depositors will find a new home in a safe, too-big-to-fail bank. That bank, of course, is J.P. Morgan in this case. The government will provide rule exemptions and mates rates on loans, like how the OCC waived deposit concentration limits and FDIC loaned $50 billion to J.P. Morgan to get them to do the deal. But a deal will get done. The whole point is for the federal government to claim it isn't bailing out a failed bank, but a private company is. It's a bit of left hand, right hand, but those are the policies of the day. Just look at how China allocates losses as a blueprint for the U.S. As long as inflation remains high and the politics surrounding banking credit and debit are toxic, there will be more contorted solutions to try to confuse you as to who bears the loss. If you aren't one of the 8 too-big-to-fail banks, you are effed. As long as inflation is sticky at these high levels and possibly rising, today I will choose a bank with large CRE exposure and 50% to 50% OTM puts that expire before June. This is Arthur, of course, being the trader and betting against small and mid-sized banks. What do you think of this idea? Nationalizing, we are de facto nationalizing the U.S. banking system.
Well, it reminds me of the article that he wrote, which brought him onto the podcast last time, which the whole theme of that article is... the destination is known, but the route is uncertain. He was actually applying it in a different way, but I'll apply it here. The destination is a nationalized financial system because that is the era that we live in, the era of the CBDC. It becomes really easy to roll out a CBDC when there's only 8 banks in the commercial banking sector. And so like that is the conclusion of things. A financial system that is just highly centralized, controlled with a ton of oversight and a ton of regulation, because it's not hard to control things when there's only 8 banks. And so this is, to me, a convergence upon that. We talk about CBDCs and like the evils of CBDCs because it just means central control. Yeah. So this is the convergence that we're going towards.
Here's the insidious thing about this too, is like you heard him talk about like these contorted measures that were being made. They're not going to announce that the U.S. banking system is being nationalized. No, right. There's never going to be legislation that goes in front of Congress, which is like, check yes or no. Let's do a vote. Should the U.S. banking system be nationalized or not? Mm-hmm. It'll happen like this, slowly. And with them doing the theater of basically, we're not nationalizing it. It's private. See, J.P. Morgan, look, a private company went and won the bid. Right. So it'll happen. Like no one will directly tell you that that is what is actually happening. As an investor and as a participant in this economy, you just have to keep your eyes open and connect the dots and see the pattern playing out. And you're right. I think that is the destination of this. Just don't expect the trumpet from Jerome Powell saying we are nationalizing the banking system, because they know that that would be soundly rejected by the American people.
Well, the way that you're saying is that like they are the puppeteers of this master plan and they want that. I'm not necessarily sure that they do want that. It is, if you zoom out and see nation state and fiat currency systems as the powers that be and with a mind of its own, that is a conclusion because the aggregate incentives pushes it there.
Oh yeah.
But like the individual players, like Jerome Powell's like, I'm going to nationalize the banking sector. He's not doing that. He's just one cell in a larger body with a direction that it wants to go in.
I agree with that too. I don't think that there's like an intent to like, I'm an evil emperor to nationalize this system, but there is an intent not to tell you that that is the game being played.
100% true.
That is exactly intentful. They're not going, like they know what they're doing. They know where this inevitably goes. They're not stupid, is kind of what I'm saying. They're not like, oops, I guess we have to take over another bank. What's going to happen? They know exactly where this is leading, but they're not going to tell you that this is where it's leading.
Dubious.
They're going to boil the frog, and which is exactly what's happening. So meanwhile, speaking of this, Balaji, all right? Do you remember the 90-day Bitcoin bet?
Yeah,
he's capitulated on it.
Yeah.
So 6 weeks, it was due June 17th. He bet that Bitcoin would hit $1 million. There'd be a cascade of bank failures. What is the status update on that, David?
Balaji tweets out, I just burned $1 million to tell you they're printing trillions. He really loves his like limericks. He loves rhyming little like quips. the $1 million bet is now closed by mutual agreement. I made $1 million in provable on-chain donations, which you can verify. $500,000 to Bitcoin Core Development, $500,000 to give directly, $500,000 to Medlock, who I think is the winner of the bet. And then he goes on to explain like why did he do this. He's basically saying the whole like BitSignal was a marketing stunt that he is paid. He just took $1 million to the face to broadcast that they are going to print $1 trillion. So that's what he said.
Did you watch his video, David?
I watched part of it.
Okay. I watched it. It was good. It was a lot of our episode with him.
Yeah, kind it was of our, a recut. It actually made me a little bit frustrated. I was like, apology. Like, you can say things in 9 minutes. Next time we do a podcast, can you do something like this, please?
I don't know. I enjoy the long form with Balaji. Although I think we had like 2.5 hours of content. We kind of pared that down to like, you know, under 2 hours or something. But
an hour 40, yeah. Uh-huh.
So I think the TLDR for people, we'll include a link in the show notes, is Balaji says it's still going to happen. It's just not going to happen in 90 days.
Right.
And he gave the parallels to this is like 2008. He said Bernanke said it was fine. That the economy is fine. And then 2 quarters later, we got hit with 2008 major recession. And so he draws parallels to that. He also draws parallels
to
COVID. By
the way, all of the federal like chair members and everyone else is like, the economy is totally sound. Banking system's fine, guys. Like that
same
was the
thing.
Messaging this week.
Yeah, he basically pulled up press releases in the same time period. And he's like, look what Bernanke said. We're fine. I, you know, didn't use the exact same terms as, you know, kind of the landing the plane term that Powell uses, but basically said, we're fine, mild, no recession. It'll be fine.
It's
and
chill,
then
guys. We
two
got
quarters
this.
Later, didn't happen. So he's basically saying, look at the signals. We got debt at astronomical levels. We've got de-dollarization happening. He's got some charts about that. We've got gold buying from central banks at all-time highs outside of the U.S. particularly. Now we have bank failures and runs. And so he's basically saying, I lost the bet, but I still got the word out. On the most important thing. That's kind of his take on it. Which is interesting because he didn't exactly tell us in that conversation. We asked him if this was sort of just a marketing stunt. He said, no, it wasn't.
So I remember thinking about that part. Because I can't remember the details, but I think he might have been saying, I am not doing this to pump the Bitcoin price to make a profit. Which
I
is
think
different
so.
Than saying I am doing this as a marketing stunt.
I also think he still views that there is a probability that it could happen in 90 days. And when we had that conversation with him, he was like, yeah, there's a probability that could happen. It's not a certainty. Right. All of this is like probabilistic. And actually, this is, I think, worth watching. I think we should watch this clip because the question is, okay, Balaji, if you still think it's going to happen, and it's not happening in 90 days now, and you're willing to capitulate on that, when is it going to happen? So this is what he says here.
And so then, of course, the question is, okay, but when? Everybody wants to know exactly when things are going to happen. So I don't have a crystal ball. My guess is 10% months, 70% years, 19% decades, 1% centuries, okay? I can give a case for each of those, that when I say 10% months, what I'm saying is, you know, we have some serious crisis in months, or 70%, I think it happens in years. And one way of thinking about this is sort of the, you know, stay in dollars or exit spectrum. If you think the current status quo of printing can go on for an endless amount of time, the U.S. establishment de facto believes it can go on for centuries, then you stick on one side. If you are seeing fire alarms, you're seeing klaxons, then you exit, whatever that means to you. Personally, as I said, I'm like 10% months, 70% years, 90% decades, 1% centuries. You should figure out what your own percentage is there. If you think that all of this is totally stupid, you know, and the U.S., of course, has infinite hit points and the Fed can print forever, then you're at centuries and you should ignore all of this. But if you have some probability that actually system collapse may happen sooner than people think, then you should, you know, take appropriate action.
What do you think of that, David? So he's giving a much more probabilistic bet here, right? And this kind of implies, you know, for him, if it's 10% months, maybe he has 10% in fiat, for example, 10% in the dollar. And that's how he allocates his portfolio.
Sure. I'm reminded that there's that quote that sometimes there are decades when weeks happen, and then sometimes there are weeks when decades happen. And I'm also reminded that Balaji was way ahead of the curve with COVID, which was an exponential event. 2008 was an exponential event. The worry that we had with the snowman and what could happen in the future, like what we're saying is like, there could be an exponential event in the future. So it's not like if Bitcoin goes to 1 million, it's not going to be like at the last second it touches 1 million and it just gets there and then it comes back down. It's going to be like, no, it'd be like, it skyrockets and it breaks the meter because of an exponential event. 10% is exactly like what he said, is an exponential event. It's a 10% chance. Like, we live in a time of chaos. The pendulum of the global order is no longer in the time, in the era of stability. That was the last four decades. It's been shifting towards chaos, and it's been shifting that way for a long time now. Yeah.
That's when you break it down. Here's what you can do. You can, what I love about this sort of thing is you can actually bet whether biology is right or not. And you don't, it doesn't have to be a binary all or nothing type of thing. You have to be like, oh, it's certain. So, and it's certain it's going to happen in the next 6 months. Therefore, I'm going to take all of my fiat. I'm going to convert it to crypto, right? Mm-hmm. You could just do a little bit of it or a lot of it, depending on where you are in kind of the spectrum. But I will say, I do, over the long run, I will not, I'm definitely not betting that biology is wrong over like the long time period. It's like, this seems totally reasonable to me that 10% probability happens in months, 70% years.
10% in months sounds like 10% in 2023. There's a 10% chance that Bitcoin hits $1 million this year.
But, we know, David, that it's 100% probability that fiat is going to like, trend towards zero over a long enough time span. Right. That's every single fiat system. Like, go chart it over time. Ray Dalio does this wonderfully, right? It's like all of them hit a reset mark. And we're like, what, 50 years into this experiment with, you know, the 1970s and the US dollar. So it's going to happen at some point. It's just a matter of when. And I don't think people fully understand that. And biology does. So I'm glad he's getting that message out.
Did you, I don't know if we have it in the agenda, but the conversation of the $1 trillion coin is back on the menu. Did you see that?
Oh, yes. I saw some of this. Yeah. This is,
we got some takes later in the show, but yeah. So the establishment has resurfaced the possibility of minting a $1 trillion coin.
What does that tell you? I mean, I'm sure that was a snippet in Balaji's video too. Yeah. I think he's brought that up actually. Uh-huh. Well, that's that. Bank failures, Balaji capitulating on his bet, but not really. He still thinks he's going to be right in the long term. David, talk about Coinbase for a minute. They are going international. What does that mean?
The Coinbase International Exchange has launched. This is up and running, offering Bitcoin and Ether perpetual futures settled in USDC with up to 5x leverage to institutional clients and people in eligible jurisdictions outside of the US. So Coinbase enters the international game. Just at a high level, Ryan, like, what do you think about this? What's your take?
I think they're not putting their eggs in the U.S. basket anymore. Not all of them. Yeah. This is smart. And the other thing I think is like, wow, I'm an American. And if you're in the U.S., if you're American listening to this episode, you don't have access to these products because your government won't let you. Yeah. You live in a financial prison that will not allow you. It doesn't think that you are able to handle Coinbase, Bitcoin, and perpetuals.
Boy. Yeah.
And that kind of sucks.
You can't play with big boy toys.
So this is not an unregulated marketplace that they're running. This is, in the EU, they can offer this sort of thing. And so, but they can't do that in America. It's sad, I think.
My take on this is really bullish for Coinbase because we know that they're like the FTX US versus FTX back before we thought knew it was a fraud. FTX International dominated in spot revenue and perps revenue, just like it was just a gargantuan.
So someone's
got to
step
US.
In basically.
Yeah. There's a huge void in the market. And so like it's bullish for Coinbase because Coinbase gets to step into that market and service that demand that we know is verifiably there. And of all the other offshore derivative exchanges that have all come and gone in the world of crypto, this is the first time that we have seen a meaningful, entrenched, established player that people trust, that operates by the rules and operates in the light, not in the shadows. And so it's bullish for Coinbase. I also think it's bullish for this industry because finally we have a legitimate player to fill that void and we have a legitimate player answering towards that demand. So it's bullish for two reasons.
Yeah, at some level, the crypto exchange game is very much about just outlasting everyone else.
Yeah,
I mean, I throw Kraken in this category too, of like just over a decade of servicing crypto and just not necessarily being fastest, but just being the most secure, most stable, most predictable, like doing the core things really well. And at the end of the day, the FTX is, they burn out. I mean, like
being fast is a huge liability in this industry. Look at Thoreau Capital.
I think
so. The low and slow game plays out real well in crypto.
Yeah. Tortoise, not hare. David, there's an entire episode about this with Tom Duff Gordon, who's the VP of International Policy, that we put out. You guys will catch that on the feed. We'll include a link in the show notes as well. Also, some more news from Coinbase. Do you remember they picked a fight with Gary Gensler? They're bringing the SEC to court. What's this tweet say, David? Here's an update on that.
Yeah, so they got a response from the court. So the Third Circuit Court just issued a text-only order directing the SEC to file a response to our mandamus petition. I hate legal talk. Within 10 days. Is that, how do you pronounce it? And what does that mean? Do you know?
No, I don't. Mandamus. Let's go with that. Anyways. the lawyer can correct us. TLDR,
the SEC has to respond to Coinbase's petition that they filed last July in 2022 in the next 10 days because Coinbase said they were going to take the SEC to court if they didn't. And so at the direction of the court, the respondent is ordered to file any answer to the petition within 10 days of the date of this order.
Cool. So Gary, you got 9 days,
Gary, from the time of
from the time that this episode releases. If you're hearing us, you got 9 days to reply to this. All right, David, what do we have coming up next?
A bunch of stuff, Ryan. We got Venmo bringing crypto wallets to 60 million Americans. We got EigenLayer Stage 1 mainnet set to launch. We got the Sui mainnet. Again, pull out the number of the market cap that you think that it is. We got an Axelar announcement, and then also the newest Zach XBT victim just dropped. So all of that and more. But first, a moment to talk about some of our fantastic sponsors that make the show possible, especially MetaMask, who not only makes the show possible, but also makes Web3 jargon easy to comprehend. So if there's ever a word that Ryan or I use that is a crypto word that is confusing to you, MetaMask has built MetaMask Learn at learn.metamask.io, which is a place to get onboarded into the world of Web3, not just for you, Bankless listener, but you, builder of a crypto company that needs to onboard your new employees to get them to understand what your other employees are talking about, also send them here. Let's go hear from MetaMask.
Learning about crypto is hard. Until now. Introducing MetaMask Learn, an open educational platform about crypto, Web3, self-custody, wallet management, and all the other topics needed to onboard people into this crazy world of crypto. MetaMask Learn is an interactive platform with each lesson offering a simulation for the task at hand, giving you actual, practical experience for navigating Web3. The purpose of MetaMask Learn is to teach people the basics of self-custody and wallet security in a safe environment. And while MetaMask Learn always takes the time to define Web3-specific vocabulary, it is still a jargon-free experience for the crypto-curious user. Friendly, not scary. MetaMask Learn is available in 10 languages with more to be added soon, and it's meant to cater to a global Web3 audience. So, are you tired of having to explain crypto concepts to your friends? Go to learn.metamask.io and add MetaMask Learn to your guides to get onboarded into the world of Web3. Arbitrum One is pioneering the world of secure Ethereum scalability and is continuing to accelerate the Web3 landscape. Hundreds of projects have already deployed on Arbitrum One, producing flourishing DeFi and NFT ecosystems. With the recent addition of Arbitrum Nova, gaming and social dApps like Reddit are also now calling Arbitrum home. Both Arbitrum One and Nova leverage the security and decentralization of Ethereum and provide a builder experience that's intuitive, familiar, and fully EVM compatible. On Arbitrum, both builders and users will experience faster transaction speeds with significantly lower gas fees. With Arbitrum's recent migration to Arbitrum Nitro, it's also now 10 times faster than before. Visit arbitrum.io, where you can join the community, dive into the developer docs, bridge your assets, and start building your first dApp. With Arbitrum, experience Web3 development the way it was meant to be. Secure, fast, cheap, and friction-free.
David, this is absolutely huge. No one's talking about it. Venmo is bringing crypto wallets, the gateway to crypto wallets, anyway, to 20 million Americans. Do you want to hear the Ryan Sean Adams hype tweet about this before we get into what happened?
Straight into my veins, sir.
All right, let's go. Okay, Venmo is now allowing its 60 million customers to withdraw directly to a non-custodial crypto wallet. Exit the banks and go bankless. FinTech has become a gateway to crypto. Crypto is quietly eating the world. Just no one is noticing because it's a bear market. That's the take here.
There's a lot of words in that tweet that I like, man.
Well, tell us what really happened. Ground us in reality. What's going on with Venmo when we get past the hype tweets here? Introducing crypto transfers for Venmo customers. What does that mean?
The big news here is that Venmo is no longer just a place to buy crypto assets, but you can now make Ledger updates to these crypto assets because these things are money and you need to make ledger updates to money because that's how money work. So you can send your crypto to other Venmo users inside of the Venmo ledger, the Venmo centralized database ledger, but you can also sidechain, maybe. But you can also make a decentralized open permissionless blockchain ledger update by sending your crypto assets to another wallet. This is just basically Venmo doing payments, so which isn't any surprise. But it's a very big company with 60 million users making on-chain ledger updates of Ether transfers and stablecoin transfers in using our blockchain payment rails. And so this is all rolling out to customers May of 2023. I know it's like it's a small deal because, yes, we can now transfer crypto. We've already been transferring crypto. But now Venmo, 60 million people are able to transfer crypto using Venmo. So big.
I think it's the big thing here is to non-custodial wallets. That's the exit, wallets, yeah. Right? Like this is like DeFi mullet thesis playing out, which is basically like fintech provides a user interface for a crypto, which is more difficult, but it's all built on top of those ledgers, the decentralized ledger of Ethereum, Bitcoin, other cryptocurrencies. And now we can hold our own private keys. So our job, I think, as a crypto community is to get those 60 million people into bankless wallets. That's what we got to go do next. We got to go do that hard work.
Before they shut the gates.
before they stop letting us. David, we got mainnet season here. Who's going to mainnet this week?
Coming up first in mainnet season, we got EigenLayer. So EigenLayer has been extremely hyped. This is the topic of restaking. EigenLayer really opened up the door to the concept of restaking. And so they are launching their mainnet stage one mainnet soon TM. They said they've got over 9,000 submissions with interest between 0.1 ETH and 30,000 ETH to all begin doing restaking things, to restake for other networks. And so,
what does restaking mean for people, right?
I'm so glad you asked, Ryan. Restaking is when you stake your ETH to Ethereum and then you stake it again.
Double stake?
Do you have further questions?
Okay, so does that mean I get, like, I could stake it twice in Ethereum, or am I staking it somewhere else? Okay. What does that mean?
So restaking, are you familiar with merge mining? I know some listeners aren't, so I'll answer the question anyways. Merge mining is when you have an ASIC, like a Bitcoin ASIC, and you use your ASIC to mine Bitcoins, but you could also mine another network at the same time that operates on the same hashing algorithm. So if you're mining for Bitcoin, but you're just doing a SHA-256 mining algorithm, you can also simultaneously mine for another chain because it uses the same hashing algorithm. Restaking is the same concept for Ethereum proof of stake. So you
For a token, Ether.
So you stake your Ether to Ethereum, but then instead of also, when you stake your Ether to Ethereum, you are signing up for slashing conditions. If you propose an invalid block, you get slashed. If you missed your block slot, you get marginally penalized. There are certain slashing conditions that come with the responsibility of being an Ether holder, an Ether staker, and restaking lets you sign up for new slashing conditions for new networks, completely new networks. Another layer two, an Oracle network, literally anything. And so this is why when I just leave it open-ended and like let you stake it again, it's intentionally open-ended. You can stake it to any network that needs security just by signing on for new slashing conditions. And EigenLayer is like the hub for all of this.
You're not just signing up for new slashing conditions because that doesn't sound too fun. You're signing up for rewards
new
as
rewards.
Well.
Right.
You're taking risk and rates.
You're getting paid for it.
Exactly. And so the risk is the slashing, but the reward is basically if you have a 4.5% APR on Ether staked in that protocol, you can also take that staked ETH and you can use it to secure another protocol. Now you have some risk there, of course, but then you get some reward for that. So this is really cool. This is like Ether as an internet bond. I think we're going to do entire episodes on this concept of restaking the future because it is that big for ETH as a monetary unit and also for like the entirety of cryptocurrency. I mean, it's going to shake everything up if this is successful, I think.
Yeah. And if bankless listeners' minds are boggled and you have further questions, I have great news for you. An article that I wrote went out on the Bankless newsletter yesterday at the time of listening, which are kind of the theme is like the big questions that restaking brings to the table, that EigenLayer brings to the table. And so I explain restaking in further detail and I go through what I'm calling the restaking meta. This is a big deal, by the way. I would like to plant my flag and say this is a significant deal. In the same way that, like, once upon a time we had these arbitrage bots, and then one of these arbitrage bots did something weird by, like, reordering transactions when they were proposing a MEV. And then we discovered the world of MEV, and, like, our minds were blown, and it's like the entire industry shifted. This is like restaking. And so the whole, like, Justin Drake, Dankrad, Vitalik are all talking about how does restaking change the natural equilibrium of the staking industry, because we don't know the answer to that question.
MEV is a good analogy here, because there's some good things about it, right? Mm-hmm. And it increases, you know, yield and rates and all sorts of things. But there's also some scary things about it, right, in the way that it could shake things up and change protocol incentives. So we're doing episodes on this too, right? In the future, so we have an episode for you. But that was just the first of a couple of mainnets. Mm-hmm. What's this one, David?
The Sui network. I think the sister network to Aptos. I think these are, like, coming around the same time. The newest, shiniest layer one blockchain on mainnets. So they are boasting a whopping number of 100 globally distributed validators to achieve a peak throughput of 300,000 transactions per second with finality inside of 480 milliseconds. So these are the numbers, the super speedy layer one. I have not looked under the hood of this thing, but I'm going to classify this as what I would call a juice layer one. Ryan, have you come up with your number?
I already knew the number, so it's not fair for me to actually say what that number is. But I will say it surprised me when I first learned what the number was.
The market cap of fully diluted valuation of Sui is coming in at $13 billion. $13 billion.
Wow.
Just launched to mainnet. So went from Series A, Series B, launched to mainnet, coming in at $13 billion, making it the number 66 crypto asset. It's got a market cap of $700 million. And I would like to point out the discrepancy between the market cap and the fully diluted valuation. I will also say that some layer twos have this discrepancy as well. $13 billion is the fully diluted valuation. $700 million is the market cap. That means there are $12.3 billion of tokens locked up that have not been issued to the network that has to be absorbed by sufficient buying pressure to justify a $13 billion valuation.
Because the way, like, Sui and CoinGecko values market cap is based on the circulating supply, which is very low right now.
Right.
5%.
I mean, this is a normal thing at the beginning of all networks, but it is also a symptom of a VC chain. Interestingly,
it's something you have to watch out for, because when you're buying a Sui token, you're actually, I think you're totally, I always value these things as the fully diluted valuation, because this is a long-term what it's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. The Series B, Ryan, do you know who led the Series B?
Polychain, Multicoin, one of the big layer two investors. You know the names, am I right?
No, FTX Ventures.
which
they were forced to sell their stake for $96 million recently, which was probably a fumble, because if, I don't know how they valued it, they had to liquidate for $96 million. I don't know what the valuation is, but, like, the Series B valuation was $2 billion, and we are currently at a 6.5x of that. So I don't know if that was a fumble or not, but I'm assuming they sold it somewhere between $2 billion and $13 billion, but not $13 billion.
I guess they didn't want to speculate, huh? Yes. All right, so we got some more releases.
I will just say that the tone that I just gave about Sui was totally biased and definitely negative, and I'm totally aware of that, and that's my deal.
Wait, your deal is being biased and negative?
Yeah, towards centralized new layer ones. Totally. Yeah.
Why? Because they have to prove themselves, or because you hate them, or because you're bag biased and you're angry that you didn't get on this deal? Why is your tone negative?
Because I believe in constrained layer ones that are not led by VCs.
We've done this before.
We've seen this game. Many times. We already know how this works.
Many times. You definitely have to prove yourself. That's a hefty valuation for just shipping to mainnet on a new layer.
For an empty ghost chain. Yeah.
Hefty valuation.
There's a lot of growth priced in there.
All right. Axelar, what's up with them? Going to mainnet too. That's number three.
Yeah. So Axelar is a network. It's a IBC Cosmos network that connects Cosmos to Arbitrum. So it's a bridge protocol, which previously Bankless has been like dubious about, and I'm still not totally sold, but something's new about Axelar. We did a show with them, which is why I know about this. They have this thing called GMP, General Messaging Protocol. So instead of, Ryan, instead of sending tokens cross-chain, they send computation cross-chain. So the tokens stay on the respective chains, but the logic passes through chains. So there's less
that seems
risk.
Totally. Yeah, that I don't have a problem with that. But right. The challenge with bridges is kind of like the security risk
token
you
security.
Expose yourself
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
Token security risk. And you're saying it's not taking that type of risk.
It can take that type of risk. But it does the correct, in my opinion, the correct order of operations, which is it passes data, which is less valuable. And then once you build a secure messaging protocol and you go to mainnet with that and you and that's what you ship for production and let that be battle tested in the wild, you can then layer tokens on top of that. Mm. And like this was like the breakthrough that I had. It's like, wait a second. Why did all the other cross-chain bridges not do that? Why did they just skip to the tokens? So there was a Bankless
show.
What
kind of data? Like, what kind of data is it?
Okay, so part of this announcement is this thing called Sommelier, which Zaki Mannion from the Cosmos ecosystem, we've had him on Bankless. Right. That's his project. Right. Sommelier is like this cross-chain yearn, if you will, and manages assets across chains. But because of Axelar, is able to manage. So this is actually plugged into Arbitrum. So this is an Arbitrum, Axelar, Cosmos partnership, collaboration, where Sommelier, Zaki's DeFi app, is able to reach across chains and manage yield and assets across chains. Yeah.
Manage yield and assets, but not actually transfer them.
Transfer them, yeah.
So you're not actually changing the security profile of the assets themselves.
Yes, correct.
Huh. Yeah. That's kind of cool.
Right, yeah.
I mean, personally, I mean, we know that bridges are going to be necessary. Probably. With all these chains, we need a lot of bridges.
Yeah.
I think you're more in favor of kind of like trustless bridges, like layer two style bridges,
right,
rather than having kind of a mesh network of dubious multi-sig bridges.
Correct.
And
that
get
spun up inside of a bull market, inside of fervors that are like, our bridge is totally safe.
Oops.
Yeah.
Hack.
No, I'm
North Korea's got our money now.
I'm a big fan of putting logic at risk before putting tokens at risk.
Hey, there you go. Yeah. Well, it seems logical, David.
It does.
All right. And lastly, David, we've got a mainnet update. This is really cool, actually, from Lens. Mm-hmm. So they just launched a layer three.
Layer three.
I believe. Tell us what they launched and then give us the stats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they renamed the layer three and we weren't able to fit it into last week's rollups. This layer three is called Momoka by Lens. So Stani tweets out 7 days later, Lens has finalized 5.4 thousand transactions for a total cost of $4.4. That's for all of the transactions. So the average transaction on Momoka is 0.0008 cents with a peak of 25,000 transactions per second.
That is awesome. Yeah. He says close to S3 pricing. That is Amazon, AWS, data storage pricing.
I needed you for that one.
Well, you know what? I think this is awesome. This is basically, remember Lens, of course, is a Web3 social protocol. So Web3 social can be cheap now because we have broadband.
Yeah.
That's what's so exciting about this. Right. And I'm really excited about these use cases moving forward now that we have very cheap transactions.
Right. And now I will remind Bankless listeners, does that $13 billion Stewie network look all that great to you?
Stop. You said you would stop, David.
Say I would stop?
No, you didn't.
No,
you said
I didn't.
That is the new you, actually.
Yeah. I said
never
that's
mind.
My deal.
That's David's deal now. So now I feel like I have to compensate by being nicer to the alternative layer ones.
I don't think you need
just
to.
Just for
that.
You. No, I don't need to bring
need
balance
to
the universe.
You don't need to feel compelled to do that.
How about this? Newest Zach XPT victim. One crypto wallet launched 114 dodgy meme coins in 45 days. David, what's the story here?
So there's just a business model, I guess, in like spinning up random new meme coins. Zach says every time stolen funds from the scam are then sent to the same deposit address. So I'm guessing like some like weird new term comes up and then this one person makes a token that is that term and then convinces every people to buy it and then makes some profit and then rinses and repeats that. Zach found them because they were using the same wallet. Wow, look at that graphic. That is insane.
I mean, let me just remind you, listener, because, and I'm reminding myself, buying a meme coin is a choice. That's a choice that you are making. All right. You don't have to do this. You don't have to invest, quote unquote, in crypto this way. In fact, I think you're deluding yourself if you're calling it an investment. Yeah. You take 1%, 2% of your crypto portfolio and you do something like this, totally degen. That's one thing. But I think a lot, I don't understand why people are playing these games, David, when there's active scammers out there just stealing their money.
It seems
and
exhausting.
Yet we continue to play them.
Yeah.
David, speaking of exhausting, the Dame tax, or is that damn tax? I don't know. Feels like a damn tax. The Dame tax, making crypto miners pay for costs they impose on others. This is from the White House. Mm. Biden administration is proposing a 30% tax on crypto proof of work mining. What's your take on this?
Negative. Because in the same way that I do not think that we should politicize our banking sector, I also think that we should not politicize our public infrastructure, our energy grids. Grids who should and can access energy should be not governed by politics. And so my take is that if you are deeming some consumption of energy as some reasons to consume energy as legitimate and others illegitimate, that is bad. And we should not have that involved with our government. Our government should not be able to dictate who can access energy. Energy is real important. And so, yes, it's easy to harp on crypto miners. No one likes crypto miners except for the crypto industry and not even all the crypto industry. And so it's really easy to go after crypto miners to pay for the cost that they impose on others, quote unquote. But it's also not saying that, hey, anytime you consume electricity for any reason, you are increasing the prices for everyone else because there's only so much electricity to go around, and that's how grids work. And so my take on this is politicizing our public infrastructure to say that some things are good and some things are bad, and that is not the role of government, is my take.
I think that's a controversial take in some places because they'll say, David, are you ignoring the energy problem? Are you ignoring climate change? Are you doing that sort of thing? I think I agree with your take too, with one kind of caveat or addendum. I think you were also saying this is when you're saying you don't think we should politicize our energy grid. Some people will point out, well, David, it's already politicized. All right. We regulate solar and wind farms and dirty coal and all of these things. And my take is it's different when you regulate the supply versus regulating the demand.
Right.
The demand part of things is where I think you get into particular trouble. Who is the government to decide how energy should be used based on anything, right? Like that seems to be a slippery slope. Let's say, you know, the Grinch gets elected as president in 2024 and the Grinch just hates Christmas and puts a 40% tax on Christmas lights, right? I mean, and Bitcoiners make this argument all the time. Christmas lights actually cost more energy to the grid than Bitcoin mining.
That's
insane. And so you get into this slippery slope of creating kind of like politicizing the demand, the demand side of the energy grid. And that's where I think you get in trouble. Right. But that's also a controversial opinion because people say, David, you're ignoring climate change. But I don't know that you're saying that. I think you'd probably be in favor of regulating
tax,
dirty coal plants on the supply
side,
for instance.
Output of energy producers. That's a simple answer there.
There you go. Well, that's what's happening. Biden administration, unfriendly to crypto for sure. We got your jobs of the week. Even in a bear market, crypto companies, crypto protocols, everybody's hiring. We got a lot of jobs on the board. Why don't you tell them about the first one? An investment analyst intern. What is this?
Oh, I'd be happy to, Ryan. Bankless Ventures has an investment analyst intern job. Yes, Bankless Ventures. Ryan and I, if you have not heard, are starting a VC firm with our good friend Ben Lakoff, and we need an intern. I think this is probably one of the sickest jobs that exists in the crypto world. So if you are interested in interning for BVC, Bankless Ventures, click the link in the show notes, go to bankless.palette.com/jobs. And I'll be talking a little bit more about Bankless Ventures and what I am bullish about. Hint, I'm perhaps bullish on Bankless Ventures.
There you go. Coinbase needs a staff blockchain engineer as well, and a staff smart contract engineer, a software engineer for mobile, and a software engineer front end at Phantom. David's dancing now. You know he's excited about Premia, the Web3 product management architect lead role, Denera, smart contract engineer, Uniswap, hiring a ton, back-end engineer, product designer, senior mobile engineer. Ooh. We got a whole bunch more over the Bankless job boards. It's feeling a little bullish. On the job boards right now, talent is firing. This is a good time to get a job in crypto. Guys, we got a lot coming up. David, why don't you tell them?
Coming up, we got the takes from the week. We got some good ones. Eric Voorhees on fire this week. We also got some questions for the nation. We got three questions from the nation we're going to run through. And then we're going to go to what David and Ryan are excited about. Hold your breath. You'll never guess. But first, I want to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible.
You know Uniswap. It's the world's largest decentralized exchange with over $1.4 trillion in trading volume. You know this because we talk about it endlessly on Bankless. It's Uniswap. But Uniswap is becoming so much more. Uniswap Labs just released the Uniswap mobile wallet for iOS, the newest, easiest way to trade tokens on the go. With a Uniswap wallet, you can easily create or import a new wallet, buy crypto on any available exchange with your debit card with extremely low fiat on-ramp fees, and you can seamlessly swap on Mainnet, Polygon, Arbitrum, and Optimism. On the Uniswap mobile wallet, you can store and display your beautiful NFTs, and you can also explore Web3 with the in-app search features, market leaderboards, and price charts, or use Wallet Connect to connect to any Web3 application. So you can now go directly to DeFi with the Uniswap mobile wallet. Safe, simple custody from the most trusted team in DeFi. Download the Uniswap wallet today on iOS. There's a link in the show notes.
If you haven't yet experienced the superpowers that a smart contract wallet gives you, check out Ambire. Ambire works with all the EVM chains, the layer twos like Arbitrum, Optimism, and Polygon, but also the non-Ethereum ecosystems like Avalanche and Phantom. Ambire lets you pay for gas in stablecoins, meaning you'll never have to spend your precious ETH again. And if you like self-custody, but you still want training wheels, you can recover a lost Ambire wallet with an email and password, but without giving the Ambire team control over your funds. The Ambire wallet is coming soon for both iOS and Android, and if you want to be a beta tester, Ambire is airdropping their wallet token for simply just using the wallet. You can sign up at ambire.com, and while you're there, sign up for the web app wallet experience as well. So thank you, Ambire, for pushing the frontier of smart contract wallets on Ethereum.
Back with the questions for the week. The first one from Scotty. How bullish is 4844 for EigenLayer? I must be referring to EIP 4844. Mm-hmm. Explain that and tell Scotty why or if it's bullish for EigenLayer.
Okay, so EIP 4844 makes this thing called blob space. Instead of block space, you got blob space, which is first class blob space that is just for layer twos to put call data on. It's layer two blocks. It's layer two block space. We call it blob space because we're weird. And when we have 4844, layer twos can use all that block space and they can go super fast. And so it takes off the brakes for layer twos. So our current layer twos get better. We have more room for more layer twos. Overall, 4844 is bullish for the layer two ecosystem. It makes Ethereum turn the idea and the whole vertical of layer twos into something that's just way better. EigenLayer, I explained it earlier. These two things are not directly coupled. They are inside of the same sector. And so they experience bullishness because both grow, but there's no intimate relationship between 4844 and EigenLayer. EigenLayer can secure more layer twos. It can secure types of layer twos. There's a layer two network out there called Mantle that's using EigenLayer for data availability, but there's no intimate connection between EigenLayer and 4844. So it's just like bullish for the sector at large and gives EigenLayer more opportunity, but there's
so
no
formal unrelated. They're kind of orthogonal then. EigenLayer is restaking.
Orthogonal is like actually just like they're only
completely unrelated. You're saying they're
no, they're in parallel with each other. They're going towards the same goal, but EigenLayer is not like waiting for bated breath on 4844 or anything like that.
Got it. EigenLayer, of course, is restaking, which we were talking about earlier in this episode. David, here's another question. This one is from Jakara. Here they go. My smart friend. Oh, smart friend. Everyone should have a smart friend. My smart friend said that in 24 months, every Visa credit card will have an associated 4337 wallet attached to it. What is 4337 and how would that happen? By the way, I love Bankless, the Bankless Nation, giving us precise EIP numbers in their question. Okay, these are advanced questions. Thank you for these questions. EIP 4337. First, remind everyone.
Not EIP 4337, Ryan.
It's not? What is this?
ERC.
ERC. You got me. Yeah. You got me. It's Ethereum request for comment.
Also, rather than a Ethereum completely unhelpful phrasing of what these things are. EIP, Ethereum Improvement Proposal 4844 is dank sharding. Also a crazy name. God, no wonder this industry.
But the difference between an EIP, which is an Ethereum Improvement Request, is it's going to take some code deployed to get it working. And an ERC is just, let's all agree on a standard.
Yes.
It doesn't actually require a fork, a change in the code, not underlying protocol. So EIP versus ERC, that's the difference here.
Yeah. EIP is like, let's put this bit of code into Ethereum. ERC is like, let's agree that this is the standard that we use at the smart contract layer. So
like ERC-20s, a famous ERC. Yes. Let's all agree that this is the way we do tokens.
Top three ERC.
Top three ERC, you sure?
Yeah. I would also put ERC-4337 in there. Just since we're going down this rabbit hole, we're answering questions that wasn't asked. ERC-4337 could turn into an EIP. I don't think it would be called EIP-4337, but like you could take the guts and turn it into an EIP.
How a bill becomes a law?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Anyways, to return to the question, my smart friend said in 24 months, every Visa credit card will have an associated 4337 wallet attached to it. What is 4337? How could that happen? 4337 is account abstraction. It's a smart contract wallet. Your smart friend is smart. They are paying attention. So Visa, with the leadership of Kai Sheffield, has done like primary research and innovation into smart contract wallets using 4337 on Visa. They are building out a smart contract implementation standard so that they can use it for reoccurring and subscription payments on the Visa network. I don't know about the idea of every Visa credit card having a smart contract wallet associated to it, but 2 years is a long time. Visa is directly pioneering this effort, and that conclusion would make sense. I don't have any further information beyond that, but we know that Visa is pioneering into the world of smart contract wallets. That's what 4337 is. So your smart friend is connecting some dots and perhaps knows something.
Your smart friend is smart. Don't know about that timeline, but this is a decent prediction. It's based in some realities here. It's technically possible. David, you ready to get some takes of the week?
Love it.
We got three. Number one, why don't you read this?
Yeah, because you don't want to read your own tweet. Ryan Sean Adams says, you'll never get a country to adopt ETH as money, in quotes. We don't need a country to adopt ETH as money, he says. We need an economy to adopt ETH. The largest economy in the world will be built by AI agents. Oh, it's an AI tweet. It's an AI tweet.
Yeah, it's an AI tweet.
They'll prefer a digitally native money unencumbered by nation states. ETH is machine money. Tell us about
that's
this
it.
One. That's it.
I mean, the tweet speaks for itself. Yeah, I think that we have created a program money system that AIs are going to use, and AI agents are going to become major economic players. Like AI agents are the future. Associations and nonprofits and corporations. They are the A in autonomous. Remember DAOs, digital autonomous organizations? Well, we needed the A part. This is the A part. This is the autonomous part.
DAIOs.
Basically. Yeah. Wow. Did we just create something here? I am actually less... I think it's less important to get America to put ETH in its central bank balance sheet because the AIs are going to prefer a programmable money system that has no string, that has no geographic boundaries, has no strings attached. You don't have to file in Delaware for this thing. You spin up private keys in a multi-sig and you got a DAO cooking, right? Like robots aren't going to be able to get bank accounts. They can on Ethereum. All right. Now, hopefully that this all goes well for us, David. I know we've been talking about AI alignment. That's
don't
a
open up
separate
the AI
issue.
Rabbit hole. Don't do it.
Not going to do it. ETH is machine money though. And by the way, when I said this, people are like, you're changing the narrative already. I thought it was ultrasound money. And people are like, oh, this is, you know, world computer to ETH is machine money narrative switch. I will remind people again,
all of those go together.
They all go together. Like the internet, there are many use cases of the internet. The internet's just email. The internet is like just e-commerce. I mean, of course, these are all narratives of the internet. Mm-hmm. It's like Ethereum has many narratives. Of course it would. It has many use cases. That's a strength. Yeah. And by the way, ETH being machine money makes it even more freaking ultrasound, okay?
Right. ETH that means is ultrasound AI money to pay for computation on the Ethereum world computer. Why is that hard? So hard to understand?
I don't know why it's difficult, but anyway, that's the take, David. Let's get to another one. This is yours. Can I read it?
Yeah, but this is just Ryan and David read their own tweets.
Wow, wow. We've gotten, but mine cringe. We're just tweets. Reading our tweets
you have
back
to
and
read
forth.
All three.
Okay, no problem. David Hoffman goes, we should create an Anon account so I can read your tweets without really reading your tweets. Open money systems are public goods. The unit of account of money is a public utility. When EIP 1559 burns ETH, it's growing the value of a very widely distributed public good. EIP 1559 is a public goods mechanism. Man, your brain was thinking about money as well this week. Yeah. And ETH. Yeah. What do you mean by this?
Hang on, you got to read the other two tweets. I'm not done yet.
Oh, there's more.
Yeah.
Normalize thinking of money systems as public goods. We easily understand what happens when money systems break down due to currency devaluing. We should understand that increasing the value of money is something universally beneficial to the money system. How much investment and reinvestment has Ethereum received from ETH appreciation? How much has been donated to public goods because ETH went from 80 to 4K? How many startups and jobs have been created due to the Ethereum wealth effect? ETH is the most important public good.
So this was inspired by Hayden Adams' recent tweet about how we should redirect EIP 1559 ETH burning away from burning ETH to public goods. And I'm like, Hayden, no, don't do that. We've already had that discussion. B, stop thinking that it's not already doing that. Burning ETH is the most credibly neutral thing to do, and it's also contributing to public goods, the money that invests in this entire economy. So that's my take.
I get it. Good take. Here's a take from Eric Voorhees on a headline that he's reading from a news publication saying, $1 trillion platinum coin could save the U.S. from economic catastrophe in less than a month. It would be fast, legal, and no bigger than a regular coin. He goes, Eric goes this, thank God it would be no bigger than a regular coin. What does that even mean? What is this headline? $1 trillion platinum coin. This is a real thing. And it would be fast, legal, and no bigger than a regular coin.
Yeah, just the idea of like, it's really important that people know that it wouldn't be bigger. Like, and we're not going to waste any more metal printing this $1 trillion
wow
coin.
What would, I guess people are thinking it's like, you know, like a dinner plate size, right, coin, because like, it's worth $1 trillion.
Do you need multiple people to hold the trillion
it?
Dollar like platinum? How heavy is it?
What's it made out? Oh, it's made out of platinum.
It is.
They're really
platinum.
Trying to make this out of platinum.
What's the point
Why?
Of using a
what
precious metal?
Point?
Because like,
what is
how
the point? Unforgeable, David. You can't forge it.
Why not?
You can print
why
it.
Why not print it on paper?
This is a real conversation. So what is the context of the $1 trillion platinum coin? That's arising again, isn't it?
Right. It's because we need $1 trillion to backstop the banking crisis. Plug a hole. Is why this conversation is happening.
Isn't it the debt ceiling in Congress again? Have you been following this, David?
No,
it's
God.
Raising its head again for the, I don't know, 11th billionth
it's
time.
It's like a part of our regular cadence. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're like, well, rather than have Congress kind of raise the debt ceiling, well, let's just have Treasury mint $1 trillion platinum coin. That's why this is coming up again.
Right. So for Bankless listeners, there is a moment of Zen, which is Eric Voorhees being a stand-up comedian unintentionally. That is a very logical continuation of this conversation. So stay tuned for the very end of the episode for that.
You can enjoy that. All right, David, really what are you bullish on this week?
I am bullish on Bankless Ventures. Woo!
Hey.
So Ryan and I and Ben Lakoff are raising a fund. Bankless Ventures, $30 million early stage fund. The line that I like to give is Bankless Media, the podcast you're listening to right now, teaches you how to explore the frontier. And then Bankless Ventures gives you the money you need to establish a settlement out there on the frontier. And so we talked about this a while ago when CoinDesk broke the news before we were really able to like talk about it now. But I wrote an article on Bankless, bankless.com. You can find it. It's called Why We Are Launching Bankless Ventures. Puts some of the backstory and the ideas and the thesis behind Bankless Ventures. People are asking me like, okay, like what's the thesis behind Bankless Ventures? Like what's the deal? And the thesis is that Ryan and I have really good deal flow and we're putting it all into Bankless VC. There's certain sectors that we of course are looking at. Who's gonna buy all the layer 2 block space? Like we need startups to buy the layer 2 block space. Account abstraction. the inevitable AI meets crypto intersection. Like, all of these things are things that we're looking at, but really the idea is, because of the position of Bankless Media, we're at the center of crypto, put all the deal flow from that we get from the media network that we've created into Bankless VC. So if you're interested in learning more about Bankless Ventures, and also the inevitable conflicts of interest section, which I'm sure some people are curious about, that is available as a link in the show notes.
Yeah, and we've got some cool advisors, Justin Drake coming aboard for this, mm-hmm. Anthony Sassano, and I heard you pitching startups to come contact us as well. If you're building something really cool in crypto, get in touch.
We are mostly full out of fund, but if you are interested in being an LP, that window is still open.
True. Credit investor, all that jazz.
Gary made us do that part, the accredited investor part.
I know. Sad.
It's sad. It is sad. Ryan, what are you bullish on?
I am bullish on another accumulation opportunity for Ether, that asset we've been talking a lot about in the show. It's low. I think ETH, the price of ETH is low relative to its value. Maybe it's kind of like fair market value. Yeah. I mean, I was just looking at, you know, that website that lists all the assets, like worldwide assets. Do you know Home Depot? The company is worth more than all the ETH in existence.
That's right, not right.
David, is Home Depot stock ultrasound? Is it burning? Okay. Like, is it like the cornerstone of the internet financial system? Can Home Depot stock be restaked to secure other decentralized? I'm just like, it's silly. When you zoom out and you look at this context. And ETH is in one of those places again. It's pretty close. I'm not going to say it's exactly how I felt about this asset in like 2019, end of 2019 and early 2020, where it's just like, oh, we're definitely coming back. We're like, look at all this stuff that's being built. And we went on kind of basically like a rampage of like, ETH is undervalued. ETH is like, it's undervalued. Hello, it's undervalued. I'm not quite there. But I'm getting closer. I mean, Home Depot, David. All right.
When Ryan, in 8 to 20 years, when Home Depot stock becomes a security token on Ethereum and also collateral on the Eigen layer, I'm going to come back and be like, actually, you can restake Home Depot.
Yeah. You know what, though? What's cool is there's accumulation opportunities where other people get a chance to get on board into crypto. And I'm so glad we have these. It's like, it's, you have the opportunity to be a settler, not a tourist. When other people aren't looking, you're doing your research, you're seeing what's going on here, you're bullish on it, you could take a very risky bet. I think ETH is kind of like that right now. And it's a good time to buy, in my opinion. Not financial advice. David, we got a meme of the week. What are we looking at?
Meme of the week. Here we go. So this, I think, was a great illustration of the AI alignment problem. And so that particular one, yeah, you sent this to me, Ryan. So this is the AI alignment problem. So that little, there's this, okay, for the podcast listeners, there is this, I don't even know what you call it, a fucking monster.
A Lovecraftian
tentacles,
monster.
Like, it's spaghetti-like monster with teeth. And then all of these tentacles are converging to, like, put up this puppet face. So that it's making this face because that's what you want to interact with. That's like ChatGPT. So like the interface that you need to like talk to this monster of like tentacles and eyeballs and sensors and all that stuff. And then you make the face, and then the face outputs this like little nugget, which is like your input into ChatGPT. It's like, hey, what is like, you know, the information that I want? And then it spits out exactly what you want. Behind the scenes, there's this like Cthulhu that is making that happen. And it's unsupervised learning, like in the back, in the black box. You don't know what the hell's going on. And then you have this face that it's making because we trained it to make that face. But the face is just like a puppet of Cthulhu. And then it spits out this little nugget, which is exactly a little bit of gold. It's like, here.
A little happy smiley face.
A little happy smiley face.
Here you go. And it's RLHF. So reinforcement learning with human feedback. That's how it kind of learns. That's a smiley face.
Right.
David, I thought memes were supposed to be funny. This is making me sad.
Well, this wasn't a meme. This was a rug pull. This was education about the alignment.
Okay.
Problem. Yeah, this is us turning Bankless into an alignment podcast.
I hope this is not true, is the bottom line, right? I hope this is just an artist rendition, and we need to work to make it not true. Yeah. But the truth is, from everything that we've done so far in this AI alignment series, is we have no idea the nature
Yeah, we don't know what's back there.
Thing that we've built. We don't know if it's a Lovecraftian monster,
yeah,
or if it's just a friendly unicorn, or if it's a zombie that we can kind of like train it to do what we want, or whether it's some kind of like an early stage consciousness. Like, we have no idea. Right. And that is the scary
part. All of the above. Yeah. So yeah. Ryan, here at Montenegro, I've done 2 AI conversations right now, which I'm going to throw over to the podcast editors and underhand to you. The line that has stuck with me, which I did a full-length podcast with this guy, where the reason why AI alignment problem is an issue is because it is simply a reflection of human alignment. As in, when we look into that black box of AI, we don't understand what's going on, and then people see doom and people see misalignment, it's because it's actually not a black box, it's a mirror. And we are looking back at ourselves and be like, man, that's a human problem. Which
the monster is us.
The monster is us. Which does not make me feel any better.
On that note, we should get to the moment of Zen. David, tee it up for us.
Laugh much more.
Yeah, tee this up for. This is Eric Voorhees giving a speech as part of a debate, a classic speech from 2018. I think you're going to enjoy this. Got to let you know before we fade into that, risks and disclaimers. Of course, none of this has been financial advice. Crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in. But we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the bankless journey. Thanks a lot.
Next, let's discuss why fiat is bad money. Why should we care about cryptocurrencies and their attributes when we already have fiat? Fiat works pretty well, right? It's got pyramids and government buildings printed on it, so you know it's valuable. Also, it is backed by paper. Paper can be burned if you're cold in the winter. There's its intrinsic value. Try that with gold. But a skeptical observer should know that fiat money is an absolute scam and something altogether inappropriate for an ethical market-based society. As I like to say, you cannot have a free market when the most important good, money itself, is centrally planned and controlled. Fiat money and a market economy are mutually exclusive concepts. Like oil and water, they can certainly be mixed up together when force is applied, but they will naturally separate and dispel one another over time. Indeed, the average lifespan of fiat is less than 50 years. The US dollar only became fiat in 1971. That's less than the length of William Shatner's career. And as it happened, last week he announced that he has started to mine Bitcoins as well. Regardless, when examining its specific properties as money, most ways fiat is unimpressive. First, it is not scarce. It is systematically created out of thin air, with no limit on supply, nor can supply even be known. Fiat is willed into existence by politicians and banks because printing money enriches the printer at the expense of the public who holds the previously printed money. The phenomenon is known as inflation or currency debasement. Fiat also struggles with durability. Your fiat will only last so long as your bank permits, and even then it slowly loses its value. Your bank can destroy your fiat with the click of a button. Ask a Cypriot. Ask an Argentinian how durable fiat is. With fiat, you are ever dependent on a third party with your wealth. Is that an attribute of money that you find attractive? Some people are comfortable with it because they trust their government, but requiring trust in politicians seems a poor foundation upon which to build a prosperous society. Finally, fiat is not nearly as portable as Bitcoin. Try to send an international wire right now. You can't because it's after 5 o'clock. How quaint is that? You can try tomorrow morning, as long as it's not Sunday, because apparently God doesn't want you to use the financial system on the Sabbath. But even when successful, you'll discover it takes 3 to 5 days for your wire to arrive. You often have to physically go to the bank to do this. You have to fill out a form on paper while someone making $15 an hour takes that info and types it back into a computer. Why do people put up with this nonsense? Indeed, it is faster to strap cash to an anvil and FedEx it to Tokyo than it is to send an international wire. Do you really think that that system is going to outcompete Bitcoin in an open marketplace? And you can only send fiat if you have permission. Try to send it to a family member in Russia. You'll be censored. Want to donate to a relief effort, perhaps, in Venezuela? Too bad, you'll be censored. Are you sending a suspicious amount? Your payment will be blocked, and you better get ready for questioning or outright confiscation. Yep, the Orwellian nanny state is alive and well, and fiat currency is one of its most insidious tentacles. Fiat has these poor monetary attributes because it is a tool and appendage of the state. It exists to serve the state, not to exist market participants. Its attributes as money are intentionally constrained and inferior so as to siphon wealth to the state through debasement and to surveil and control the behavior of the king's subjects. Remember that fiat means value by decree, not by merit.